Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Listen for a report from Brian Lynn. Next is our weekly health report. Then, our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
Leila Ben Gassim wants to rebuild an area in Tunisia known as the Medina of Tunis. A local official in a village outside of the capital, Ben Gassim takes visitors to the ancient part of the city once known for specialized workers. Historically, the Medina was the heart of trade and art, and it is structured with many souks, she said, adding that each souk is used by one kind of craftsman. She said there are markets for coppersmiths and for workers making Tunisia's famous Chechia hat. The hat is exported to Libya and parts of Africa south of the Sahara Desert. Ben Gassim is also an entrepreneur with an idea. She wants to save the Medina's ancient buildings. She also hopes to bring back trades that once supported the historic area. Maybe the whole community will grow together if investment in the area tries to bring in the whole community, she said. This idea might help Tunisia's next government, which is still being organized 3 months after elections. Tunisia is the only democracy to come out of the 2011 wave of popular protests in the Middle East known as the Arab Spring. The North African country is trying to give new life to its poor economy. It is also trying to fight the poverty that has pushed people to leave. Nearly 33% of Tunisia's young people do not have jobs, and yet some craftsmen in Medina are struggling to find and train workers. At his small shop, Mohammed Ben Sassi shows an old Quran he is working on. Its pages are drawn in blue and gold. 64-year-old Ben Sassi is the Medina's last bookbinder, a person who attaches covers to books. There's demand, but young people are no longer interested, Ben Sassi said. He is not the only craftsman facing problems. Central Medina still has more than 500 artisan workshops. But Ben Gassim's research has found that number is about half of what it was 50 years ago. She believes this is a great loss for the country's identity. Throughout history, Tunisians have worked with their hands, she said. I can't imagine a Tunisian family that doesn't have an artisan. There are many reasons for the decreasing number of artisans, Ben Gassim said. The country's failing economy and currency have made some quality materials very costly, forcing artisans to look for other jobs. Bringing back these trades might also bring back an important part of the economy, tourism. Tourism has largely rebuilt Tunisia's beaches and deserts, but it has not yet touched the Medina. The area is recognized by the United Nations as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We're not promoting Tunisia with all its wealth, especially in the tourism industry, Ben Ghassim said. We haven't communicated the best story. We have communicated the easiest story. First built more than 1,000 years ago, the Tunis Medina was rebuilt under President Zain El Abidin Ben Ali. The area suffered during the 2011 revolution that ousted him. Building rules were not followed. Longtime residents left. People illegally moved into the old homes, and Tunisians from the south came to the area. However, the revolution also had a good effect, said architect Soulef Aouididi of the Medina Conservation Association. The association's headquarters is in a beautiful 19th century palace. Aouididi said new local groups are opening up. They show the Medina to school children. Aouididi's organization also brings people from many different neighborhoods. She said the group wants to help keep the old buildings as well as rebuild communities. Nearby, two guest houses offer another kind of community development. Ben Ghassim has rebuilt two old Medina mansions into small tourist hotels. Local people operate them and buy their goods from local businesses. I'm Susan Shand.
The Chinese paddlefish, one of the world's largest freshwater fish, has been declared extinct. Scientists say the paddlefish, also called the Chinese swordfish, is believed to have a lineage dating back at least 34 million years. With its long nose and mouth, the paddlefish could grow as long as 7 meters. But a research paper recently published in Science of the Total Environment reported the paddlefish was now extinct. The researchers include scientists from the Chinese Academy of Fishery Sciences, Britain's University of Kent, and the University of South Bohemia in the Czech Republic. The paper says the paddlefish was declared extinct for two reasons. None of the animals is known to exist in captivity, and no living paddlefish tissues had been saved. The paper states that the fish was not able to survive widespread overfishing and damage to its native environment in the Yangtze River. The scientists said the Chinese paddlefish had suffered major drops in population since the 1970s. The drops came as major dam-building projects were carried out along the Yangtze. Building of the Jishuba Dam began in 1970 and was completed in 1988. The massive Three Gorges project was completed in 2003, the last year a live Chinese paddlefish was seen. Researchers discovered 332 different species of fish in the Yangtze in 2017 and 2018. But they did not find a single Chinese paddlefish. They estimate the fish disappeared between 2005 and 2010. Pan Wenjing is a forest and oceans expert with Greenpeace East Asia. She told the Associated Press the extinction of the Chinese paddlefish was a huge loss for nature. She said the development confirms that the Yangtze River is experiencing major environmental damage. The ecology of the Yangtze River is close to collapse due to human activity in past decades, Pan said. She noted that China had launched a campaign to find ways to repair the Yangtze's environment, including a 10-year ban on fishing. I'm Brian Lin.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The transition from childhood to the teenage years can be a difficult time. Hormones in the body can affect a young person's emotions and moods. As children grow, they usually want to pull away from parents and develop their own personality. So they may talk or act differently as a teenager. For example, a 15-year-old who used to have a friendly personality can turn irritable. A 16-year-old who once enjoyed spending time with her family may choose to stay in her room alone. While these changes in behavior and personality can be difficult, they are, for the most part, a normal part of the teenage years. But when is it not normal? When is a change in personality a sign of depression or other mental health issues? Many parents may not know the difference. A recent poll shows that many Americans do not recognize signs of depression in their preteen and teenage children. The C.S. Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health involved 819 adults in the United States. These men and women had at least one child in middle school, junior high, or high school. Researchers asked these parents about their roles and the roles of schools in recognizing youth depression. The Mott Poll is a project of the Susan B. Meister Child Health Evaluation and Research Center at the University of Michigan. In a story on the poll, the Reuters news agency reports that a majority of parents were sure they would recognize depression in their preteen or teenager. However, 2/3 of parents admitted they had issues identifying signs and symptoms of this mental health disorder. Sarah Clark is a co-director of the study. She notes these transitions can make it challenging to understand a child's emotional state and whether there is possible depression. Clark adds that in many families, the preteen and teen years bring major changes. These changes happen both in youth behavior and the ways in which parents and children interact. Some questions in the survey asked the parents about suicide. 1 in 4 said their child knows a peer or classmate with depression. 1 in 10 reported their child knows a peer or classmate who died by suicide. In the United States, youth suicide rates continue to rise. Among people ages 10 to 24 years old, the suicide rate increased 56% between 2007 and 2017. These numbers come from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. If you think a young person is depressed and is thinking of suicide, what can you do? The CDC offers the following suggestions. Ask. If you are worried about someone, ask them directly. Are you thinking about suicide? However, mental health experts warn that you should not promise to keep their thoughts of suicide a secret. Listen. After you ask this question, make sure to listen carefully to the young person. Stay with them and listen to what they need. Be there. Follow up on the person's condition. Continue to check on them to see how they are doing. If you do not live with them, you could physically visit them often, as well as call them. Let them know you are there for them and they are not alone. Keep them safe. Take away anything that the person could use to cause self-harm. This could include anything from medications to weapons. Health experts at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health note that this is an important way to prevent suicide. Find help. People who are suicidal need professional help, but they are often unable or unwilling to find it themselves. So find a mental health expert or organization that can help them. Many have telephone hotlines for people seeking help. And that is the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And he said Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain, but Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. He urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoar spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence. The idea that all men are created equal and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some who had opposed the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States.
Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program from the Voice of America.